Now, Bradley, first I want to talk about the story with Madeline Levine. Madeline asked if it's I asked her if the university grew too fast, because she talked a lot about how a dean's position, there's so much to do for a dean and so many people under a dean that the dean can't go to every class and can't review every single professor and can't review every chair in the department. And I asked if it's grown too fast, and she said yes and no, not faster than the university can handle, but it has grown so fast that the role of dean has changed over the years. She questioned your background in the story, saying that you've talked some about, you know, being in the middle school level and how things are different from middle school to the university level. And she did say that she doesn't want to get into a shouting match, but the questions that she raised, or the thoughts that she raised, I know I want to get your thoughts on what she said in that.
Well, Levine created a straw man argument, mischaracterizing my argument and challenging points I never made. I never once suggested that deans should monitor faculty for fraud or assume they are scoundrels, as she said. That idea is asinine. And her suggestion that I made that suggestion, or her suggestion that I came up with that idea, is asinine. What I said repeatedly was that the deans should have been monitoring and supporting teaching or educational quality. So it's not about knowing what's wrong. That's what she said. She said, how can a dean know what's wrong unless somebody comes forward? It's not about what's wrong. It's about knowing what's right. That's what it means to monitor and support quality. If the deans had been monitoring and supporting what's right and educational quality, Nyangara would not have been able to go over a decade teaching subpar classes. Educational quality was not monitored, however, because research is often, and in this case, was favored over teaching. As I said in our first interview, the best headline, the most accurate headline to describe this scandal would be something like, "Research University favors research over teaching in one academic department." That's what's happened. So I believe UNC has a great opportunity here. A great opportunity. The reforms in athletics are positioning UNC to become a leader in balancing academics and athletics. Now I think there's an opportunity for UNC to become a leading research university in balancing teaching and research. And I believe and I trust that the new senior associate dean of undergraduate education starting in July, that she will help lead UNC in that direction, and I look forward to that.
Thank you for those thoughts, and I'm sure there will be more to talk about as we continue that side of the conversation. I do want to get into the Mary Willingham research application release. Now, this was part of a public records request. The Daily Tar Heel, as well as us here at WCHL, made that request to see her research application. And as I mentioned in the story, it's a multi-level application, because you see it goes back to 2008 when one was originally posted. Mm-hmm. It continues on to 2013, and there are multiple in 2013, the first of which adds Richard Southall to the application, mm-hmm. the second of which adds Jay Smith to the application as well. Mm-hmm. So has FERPA been broken from what you've seen her say and from what you've seen in the application?
Well, I don't think an individual outside of the university's FERPA officer can say with certainty whether FERPA has been violated, because every university has a set of distinct rules. But it appears, and the other point to make is that technically, FERPA only applies to institutions. So when there is a FERPA violation, it's really the institution commits that violation, and so the institution has to address the individual. There has to be some kind of consequence for the individual, or the university has to do something to show that it's doing due diligence to make sure that FERPA violation doesn't happen in the future. And so, of course, we don't know if the university addressed that with Willingham or not. And I don't know whether they can even say that. Well, I'm interested to hear your interview or read about your interview with Derrickson later. So the question, did she violate FERPA? I mean, it appears that she accessed student records without consent. That's one of the most troubling aspects of what the research application reveals, is that she did not have consent. She nowhere in the application does she say one of the purposes is to monitor grades. And so there's no consent form included in the application materials that would get consent from the students to access their academic records. And so accessing academic records without consent or without what the law says is a legitimate educational interest, that typically does qualify as a FERPA violation.
And we're joined by Bradley Bethel, UNC Learning Specialist and author of Coaching the Mind. We're speaking about the release of the Mary Willingham research application that resulted in the claims of illiteracy among student athletes at UNC. Looking at the research application, it can be kind of a confusing thing, especially since there were so many documents released yesterday because of the multiple applications, because the earlier applications were less digital, more handwritten. Mm-hmm. That kind of can be confusing as well. But I think the main points of this that we look at are, first of all, the reason for the application, the reason that she laid out as to what she was going to be studying.
Mm-hmm.
And what that lays out is talking about ADHD and learning disabilities among freshman student athletes at mm-hmm. UNC. And then also the other point of it that sticks out is whether or not she would have identifiable personal information. The reading level question never came up on the application.
Right.
And she said she would not have identifiable personal information. So those two points, I think, stand out. And if you can kind of talk about the application as to if there's any loopholes that she might have been able to get around with in that sense. And we still need to hear from Mary Willingham, too, to get her thoughts as to why she checked no or why she checked yes in certain situations. But those points, I think, are what I'd really like to get your thoughts on with seeing her application.
Well, that's absolutely right. The claims that made her the darling of some of the national media, the face of the campaign against college athletics the past 5 months, were claims about reading levels. And her research application does not mention reading levels. And furthermore, when one signs the application, they sign a statement that says, if the purposes or nature or methods of this study change in any way, I will immediately notify the IRB. Well, obviously, she never notified the IRB that she wanted to do reading levels instead of learning disabilities and ADHD. And as you said also, I mean, the more egregious, she does not include grades. She doesn't say that studying grades, monitoring grades, is one of the intentions, despite what she said publicly January 16th in the Daily Tar Heel, that the study included how they were doing in school and GPA. Now, there is one she may try, and it would be a poor attempt. She may try to cite one vague reference to the student's academic success at the end of one, maybe more. Maybe it's at the end of each of them. I haven't even gone through all the materials. There's so much at this point. But she makes some vague reference to the fact that the students in the study had actually been fairly academically successful in their first few semesters of college. However, based on everything else in the application and everything else that preceded that statement in the application, we would only assume, reading that she was able to acquire some de-identified grades of the cohort of students that she studied. Because everything leading up to that point in the application says that she won't have any identifiable information. She won't have names. She won't have birth dates. She specifically avoids checking names and birth dates. She says secondary data multiple times. So again, this vague reference at the end of the application It only suggests that she somehow acquired the de-identified grades elsewhere. So there really aren't any loopholes for her. It's actually pretty clear that she had only intended on the research application to do a secondary data analysis. And Jay Smith's email to me last September confirmed that. He said that they knew all along that the research was secondary data analysis. They should not have had the names, the birth dates. She should not have been accessing the academic records.
So you're talking about FERPA. The violation is more to the side of the university, that the fact that Willingham got the names and the identifiable information is more on the side of the university. How is that information coded then? If she's going to get coded information, what's the go between there? Is somebody at the university coding that information?
No, actually, it's not the university's fault. It's the psychologist's fault, because she would have gotten the names and birth dates associated with the test scores from the psychologist. So the way that Willingham describes the study in the research application suggests that the psychologist would only give her the test scores so that Willingham could then take this test scores and analyze the test scores, but Willingham wouldn't have any idea who those test scores belong to. So if the psychologist included with the test scores the names of the students, then that allowed Willingham to then look up those students' academic records, because as an advisor, she has access. All of us who have any kind of advising role have access to student records. So the psychologist appears to have committed some violations also, because we've been talking about FERPA, but the other issue to talk about is HIPAA, which is actually even more serious. HIPAA is the law that protects people's health information, and psychological information, the information from psychological assessments, is considered protected health information. In fact, in the application materials, there is the consent form from the psychologist regarding the information that she would be gathering from the students, and this consent form that the students sign. And on that consent form, it says very clearly that the student is signing, saying, I understand that this may be, that my information may be used for research, but the consent form is very clear, but my personal information will be detached from the data. And so whoever's doing the research would not be able to know my personal information. So if the psychologist handed over this information, the psychologist violated the stipulations of the consent form that she herself created and had the student sign. So we're talking about FERPA and HIPAA here.
Where does the SATA-RV test, the Scholastic Aptitude Test for Adults Reading Vocabulary mm-hmm. test, play into all this? Does the psychologist administer that as well?
Yes, she did. She did. Whether that qualifies as HIPAA-protected information, I don't think that would, because it doesn't require a psychological license to administer.
I guess my question is, how do you have the results from one test and not some of the other things?
That's a good question.
And is that how the connection came from, you know, we put this person with these tests? And
well, unfortunately, we don't know. Now, if the study had gone according to how it was described in the application, then what would have happened is the psychologist would have done the tests and would have coded the information or de-identified the information and then handed over the information, just the test scores, to Mary Willingham. But since that's obviously not what happened, since somehow Willingham got the names, then we don't know. Did the psychologist hand over the full psychoeducational evaluation, in which case the SATA scores would be part of all these other scores that are protected health information? That's what we don't know. But I will say this. One of the differences between FERPA and HIPAA is FERPA, only the person who is wronged can report the potential violation, but with HIPAA, anyone who becomes aware of any HIPAA violation or any potential, I got to say potential HIPAA violation, can report that HIPAA violation. And so I will be filing a thorough report on these potential HIPAA violations with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, because I think this needs to be investigated. Only the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services can determine for sure whether there were HIPAA violations that occurred here. But I think they need to investigate that, and that's why I will be filing a report that includes the psychologist, that includes Willingham, that includes Smith, and that includes Richard Southall.
Now, we're speaking with Bradley Bethel, UNC Learning Specialist and author of Coaching the Mind. This talking about the FERPA Act, the HIPAA, the research application that's been released, all of that doesn't necessarily discredit the numbers that have been found. I know the research the review experts came out with their review of it, but we're just talking about how the information was gathered. Mm-hmm. We still haven't gotten a report of, completely discrediting Willingham's findings, talking about showing the evidence of how the student athletes were to a proper reading level, or the university is accepting the right student athletes and the right people. So what's next in that? I mean, are we still just waiting for the Weinstein report to verify where the violation or the, I guess, academic improprieties were? I know we've talked about that before and in the mm-hmm. AFAM department, and waiting to see if athletics was connected, because Madeline Levine still pushed in her story I did mm-hmm. That there's still athletics involved. But we still haven't gotten that result of Mary Willingham's numbers were not completely true, other than what the three experts said in that.
Yeah, and I think what they said was pretty thorough. I think it did discredit what she said. And what they were able to find was that a little bit less than 7% of the athletes in Willingham's sample, their vocabulary scores were below high school level. One of the points that maybe has gotten lost along the way is that most school psychologists now don't even really talk about or don't like to talk about grade equivalence, because it's actually not a very precise term. And the truth is, there's not a very effective way of simply stating what a student's overall reading performance is. We would like to be able to say it's a grade level, but there's too much nuance, because there are various facets of literacy, and so two that have been talked about: vocabulary and fluency. And so you could have a student who has really high vocabulary levels, but is still a struggling reader because their fluency, because they might have a reading disability that interferes with their fluency. And so when you start to look at all these nuances, it's really difficult to just put a simple label on it. And so I think what's more important is to see how successful student athletes are once they get here. We know from admissions that they have improved the system, and that they are looking at recruits, at potential student athletes, holistically. They're trying to get a big picture of who those athletes are academically. And so I think the public and any stakeholders should demand and should expect evidence over the next few years that student athletes are succeeding. And I think that will be the measure of whether UNC is admitting athletes who are prepared or not, is to see what they do once they're admitted.
Bradley Bethel, UNC learning specialist and author of Coaching the Mind. We've had a few conversations with him over the last 2 weeks, and we will post this conversation on our website as well. We appreciate you coming back and joining us. I know you said that you'll be filing the report to investigate the HIPAA violation with the DHHS, the potential HIPAA violation. Is there anything else we can expect from you? Do you have another blog coming out anytime soon? Any plans for that?
Well, I've been asked that a lot the last few days, and I do have a couple more blog entries that I intend to post in the next week or so. At this point, I'm really gonna turn my scrutiny onto the media's coverage the last 5-6 months, particularly the national media outlets. The other question that I've been asked a few times now is whether I'm going to write a book. and I'm considering it. I will say this. When I started speaking out and challenging Mary Willingham, my intent was to write a few blog posts and be done with it. But now it's become such a part of my life. I need to take a break from it for a while, I will tell you that, and I think my spouse would be very happy if I would take some time off from this also. So I am considering the possibility of writing a book, you know, once I take a break, hopefully this summer, spend a few weeks relaxing, not thinking about any of this, and deciding whether writing a book would be the best thing to do. So I don't know for sure whether that's in the future, but if I do decide that, you'll be the first to know.
All right. we'll be looking out for that. That's good.